steering wheel. Collapse the steering wheel, yeah.
Welcome inside the Park Fermé podcast. That's what we call ourselves, believe it or not. And we are going to have fun tonight. This is Todd, a.k.a.
No, Todd, not now!
Negative Camber, of course. Hey, tonight we're going to review the Japanese Grand Prix. And before doing that, I do have to introduce my guest, because he knows a lot more about racing than I do, being a, you know, a professional and all that stuff. But you know who this is.
Ripped from out of the wasteland. He's bad. He's beautiful. He's crazy. It's...
Hello, everybody. This is Paul Charles, the international.
Damn right it's Paul. Paul, how you doing?
That's right. I'm good.
Paul, very important to know, and I think we need to be transparent. We need to be transparent up front on this podcast. We did not overspend on this podcast. I'm just going to tell you.
Far from it.
Far from it. Yes.
If we did, we would. This podcast would only be 30 minutes long because it'd be so much faster.
Yeah, it'd be 37 minutes long and 28 laps is all we'd cover. You know, that's how we roll. You know, strict. You know, we're you know, hell bent for rules.
That's right. We love we rules.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
Transparency.
And transparency, apparently.
And not spending money.
And not spending money because we don't have any to spend. That's a problem. Yeah. Imagine what we could do if we were monetized. You know, it'd be amazing, the stuff.
Would be.
You know, I think about sometimes, Paul, not to get on a segue, but I think about all of the content we generated years ago that was, people are like, hey, we should do this now that Formula One's popular and we do this. And it's like, wow, we did that, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm not bemoaning everything. It just means to tell me that back then when we were having all these brilliant ideas,
we were in the right direction.
Yeah. We were in the right direction. We were just ahead of our time, maybe, huh?
Yeah. Yep.
Or really behind our time.
Yeah. Now, wasn't there a time we were actually trying to get Zach involved?
Yeah.
Yeah. Remember that?
We had yes.
Like semi-serious conversations.
We did. Yeah. Yeah. Had conversation with Bob Varsha and everybody else. Yes. Ooh. Back in the day, in the halcyon days. Yes, in the halcyon days before, you know, the world turned upside down. Mm-hmm. Paul, let's talk about the Japanese Grand Prix, shall we?
Yeah, the sprint race. I loved the fact that they just did a sprint race this weekend.
It was a sprint
race.
It
really changed it up, you know?
That's what it was. It turned into a Japanese sprint race. The sprint race we didn't know we had scheduled for the Japanese Grand Prix weekend.
Yeah.
Shockingly, that's what it turned into. So up front, let's set the table, shall we? I thought we'd set the table for this podcast and this race by first getting the big chunks out of our broth, out of our Japanese Grand Prix
the
broth.
The dirty laundry. Let's show it off.
Yeah, let's get the big rocks out of the way, and then we can go through and talk about the team. So let's talk about what everyone is talking about. It's all the controversy. Nicholas Latifi in the points. No, that's not what we're talking about. I jest. All right. So
see,
let's get,
kids, I proved you wrong.
That's right. Points. I deserve to be an F1. I scored points. Damn it. All right. So let's get the obvious out of the way. Pierre Gasly was handed a penalty for driving too fast under the safety car and eventually the red flag. That's one issue. And the penalty that they gave him is punishment for doing so.
Mm-hmm.
But it really is a separate issue from the much bigger issue at hand, which was that there was a recovery vehicle, a tractor, on track before all the cars had made it back around to the pits or back around bunched up safely at speed behind the safety car.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, they had the red flag. So they, you know, ultimate would have been everybody into the pits. But they, even if they didn't red flag that, and some were saying, well, they should always wait until they're safely back in the pits. Well, that doesn't apply at every race. They should all wait until all cars are safely bunched up behind the safety car.
Right.
Right. Then once you have that situation, then you could bring the recovery vehicles out. Mm-hmm. So especially in these conditions, having the recovery vehicle on track, my gosh, you know, clearly it brought back memories of 2014. So, yeah. But one thing I did is I was curious, Paul. I went back and I watched Pierre's onboards, and the team didn't tell him anything about a recovery vehicle or a tractor on track. And to be honest with you, I don't think they had any idea that there was one out there.
Well, I mean, yeah, they should have known. The stewards of the meeting are supposed to inform the teams via voice, if they have a voice, mm-hmm. or by communications, text communications on their board of information that they're constantly getting, I'm sure. And so the teams should absolutely be informed. Usually the stewards would say, you know, there is a slow vehicle on track at this turn. Please use extreme caution in that area. Because, you yeah. know, in most races now, we have the yellow flags. We have the catch up to the pace car. They want you to catch up to the pace car, as you said rightly. So that gives a much longer gap of no cars going by so the marshals can clean up the mess. They don't want everyone coming in and out of the pits and catching up and et cetera. So, right. Yeah, I don't know what communication they got from the FIA about that vehicle on track, if any. And if they did right. get it, then shame on them for not passing on to Gasly, because that's their job.
Well, that's what I was wondering. Did the team tell them that? And if they didn't, yeah. which I on his onboard anyway, yeah. there was no radio message that I heard from the team to Pierre to tell him that there was a recovery vehicle on track.
Right.
And then it got me thinking, well, did the team know? Right.
Yeah.
And that was sort of echoed because Sebastian Vettel himself radioed to his team and said, you know, it'd be really nice if they would let us know that there's a tractor on track.
Well, it's imperative that they do. And it's, yeah. they shouldn't be any vehicle ever going on the track without the teams being informed immediately
right.
that thought was in process.
Right, right. And that's not just a Formula One thing, Paul. You've done stewarding and marshalling at Sonoma and many racetracks, and you've managed race and recovery vehicles and emergency medical vehicles. You've done that, and that's a standing rule. No.
Yeah, it's a stand, yes.
The yeah, lines nothing
of communication, you know,
yeah.
very, very important, you know, bar things about the race, but the safety aspects and getting everyone gathered up and attending to something that's happened on the track is priority one. Of the steward's job. And
right.
So if two teams missed it, then it kind of leans towards the FIA not following proper procedure in alerting the teams that was there.
Right.
Now, Gasly got a penalty, but you can't give the FIA a penalty for not informing the team.
Yeah, right. Right.
Right? I mean, right. your job as a driver usually is to really, literally, they, you know, they want you to hustle up and go. In the rain, obviously, you know, it's a bit dicey. You don't know when you're going to hydroplane, so you have to keep your speed as low as possible to be safe. But in turn, you know, they're a Formula One driver and they're used to going at much larger speed. So I'm sure whatever speed it was, I looked in the camera, it didn't seem absurd to me, but it is an absurd speed if there's a safety vehicle at the edge of the track.
Yes. Yeah.
Right.
Let's unpack that just for a second, because I think it's a really important point that. I know better than go look at social media right after something like this. It's just a mind vomit. Mm-hmm. But I think that's an important point that you make here. And I don't want to overplay this, but if this was a dry race on any other given race, if there's an accident, safety car comes out, the cars that are coming out of pits or whatever, they do want to hustle quickly to get on the back of that safety car pack.
Right.
And that is standard operating procedure. Had this been a brilliant, sunny, dry day, warm weather at Japan, he would have been hustling it. Not full beans, but he would have been hustling it pretty good to get back on the backpack, mm-hmm. to bunch those cars up, and then the marshals come out, extricate the vehicle, mm-hmm. and then they restart, right?
Yeah.
That's typical to hustle to get back behind that car. A lot of people said, you know, he had no reason to go fast at all. Well, that's kind of what they do. They always right. hustle to get on the back. Now, Paul, I guess the argument could be made, it's normal for him to hustle to try to get behind that safety car and bunch mm-hmm. up, but was it abnormal in the speed he was doing in those kind of conditions with very limited visibility. I guess that's what the FIA was arguing.
Yeah, but they're judging. That's a judgment call. That there's no specified speed at that point. I mean, you have virtual safety car options.
Right.
I mean, in my mind, if you want to do this kind of thing, then yes, you hustle up to the safety car, but not in that area. But that needs to be denoted by the FIA, say, from turn 7 to 8, virtual safety car speed.
Right. Right.
Right. Slow right. zone. And that leaves you the whole track to then hustle back up again. And I honestly, I've thought about this for a while. I think this should be done all the time.
I agree.
Whether it's in the dry or in the wet, obviously visibility was awful there at that point.
Well, and you bring up a brilliant point, and not surprising because you're an IMSA in sports car, but this has been solved by them by the slow zones, you know?
Well, IMSA don't have slow zones, but yeah.
But you know what I'm saying? You're in GT racing and WEC does, and you're familiar with it, and you know how it works.
Yeah.
And so in those cases, you know, they could easily do that by sector, right? Mm-hmm. In Formula One. So if the crash is somewhere in sector two, then sector two is a slow zone, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that would be easy enough to do. And to minimize a driver catching up with a safety car at speeds that perhaps are unsafe for conditions, right?
Right, right.
So having said all that, boy, the Sky crew took a lot of incoming hate when Johnny Herbert, Paul, and Karun suggested that part of the blame for the whole situation was on Pierre because he was driving too fast. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of thinking, well, it may have been, but, you know, fair point. Like we discussed, he's trying to catch up with the safety car in the pack. He just put on that new front wing and full wets. And so, but irrespective of Pierre's pace, the bigger elephant in the room is the recovery vehicle that should not have been on the track in those conditions at that time, because it's the very thing that caused the tragedy in 2014 with Jules Bianchi.
At the same track.
Yeah. And Jules Bianchi was a very close friend of Pierre Gasly, so it was obviously it rattled him to his core.
Yeah.
As it would anyone, right?
Mm-hmm. It's very personal, yeah.
Yeah, very personal, right? From that perspective, Paul, having you having worked a lot of races, a lot of tracks in your day, where did you see the error on the tractor on track? Do you think it was just a breakdown? Is your hunch? Let me ask this because we don't have definitive data. And the FIA's ham-fisted. They kind of came out and kind of pointed out Pierre going quickly, but didn't mention the tractor. And then like 3 hours after the race, they kind of said, well, we took some, you know, feedback from drivers, and we're going to have a full investigation. But what's your kind of your hunch on that? Was that
my hunch is it's, you know, certain members of the team go to every race, but at every race, you're also dealing with locals. And we've seen it before, you know, many times before, where the local marshals, whatever, kind of do things on their own recognizance. Maybe it's communication breakdown. It's not like they're all together for a whole year. They're together for like 3 days to try and put on a Formula One event. So communications can break down. Things can be misinterpreted. And some things they'll do, marshals would do normally for their normal racing series, do not apply to Formula One race, but their instinct would be to do what they normally do. Sometimes. Right. So that's what I feel it must have been. The communication breakdown before the FIA, obviously you should never send a vehicle out there. They know that, but they can't control someone who's in a marshalling stand that decides to drive a truck out, or who's in control of that station making that decision on the assumption that they're doing the right thing.
And I want to give, you know, everybody's dragging the FIA through the streets, you know, and stoning them. But I do want to have some deference for the FIA in as much as the two things that have kind of happened here relatively close together are decisions that are made that I think are sort of born out of the pressure that they're under to deliver exciting racing. If you think about getting a race restarted quickly, you know, don't want to finish under red flag or yellows, you know, they want to get a race started quickly again. Right. And in this case, it's sort of there's a lot of pressure to get those cars removed quickly. Think about what happened at Monza, with how long it took to get Dan's car off, and everybody was just apoplectic about how long it took to get his car off the track, and everybody was furious that it took him that long to do so. This is crazy, and this is the top form of motorsport, blah, blah. And in this case, they jumped the gun to quickly get that car off the track so they could restart if they were going to restart. Yeah. And you know, there's margin for errors in both of those.
Yeah, but to me, that, you know, these should be the best stewards in the world, because we're dealing with the biggest, best series, or certainly most expensive. Agreed. Right? So if they can't handle the pressure of being able to get a car off the track, then they're not the right person for the job. This is their job. So I get you kind of saying, well, it's a lot of pressure. Well, yeah, but that's what you're paid for.
Yeah, yeah, it's
and
true.
And that's when true. You need to deliver. It's pretty easy to sit back there with nothing going on and just go home at the end of the day. But this is what they do, what they should be doing every day, or thinking about doing every day. Yeah. So,
yeah, that's true. Yeah. The other major issue, Paul, was the point system. So, so the FIA announced at the beginning of the year they had a new reduced point system for truncated or shortened races. Mm-hmm. And the entire world sat listening to all the broadcasters who thought the restarted race would run approximately, we'd have just about, so there was that 3-hour window, right? And the clock was already ticking, had chewed away an hour and a half, 2 hours, whatever it was. And so by the time they did get restarted, it was about 40 minutes late or left, as we jokingly said it was a sprint race, basically. Mm-hmm. And the broadcasters were saying there's probably just about enough time to run about half distance-ish, and that because of that, it would pay out fewer points. You know, and in that case, if it paid out fewer points, and the way the results ended initially, even with Leclerc getting demoted to third, Max would have to wait to Austin to get the championship. But that's not what the regulation suggested. The regulations say that the reduced point system is only applied if the race is not restarted. And this one was restarted, so full points were on offer, even though they only had enough time left for 28 laps, which began a lot of head scratching by fans thinking, well, wait a minute.
Yeah.
What if there was only time left for 8 more laps? Would that be full points? The letter of the regulation would say yes. Yeah, if it was 8 laps, which they were thinking, okay, well, wait a minute, that isn't right. And people were saying, oh, even Christian Horner said it was a mistake. Well, that's what Christian was alluding to. Not that giving Max the title was a mistake. He was saying that, yeah, the wording of that's a little weird.
Yeah, I read a little bit about this, and the teams were involved in the wording of this document.
Right.
And everyone looked at the document as saying something different than it actually said, and I think the FIA were kind of handcuffed to do exactly by the letter of the law, because God knows if they don't, then, you know, there's going to be Armageddon again, right? So even though the teams interpreted it one way, and the thought behind this paragraph or page in the rules was supposed to do something different, it didn't as it was written. So they had to stick with as it was written. Yeah. But it was a big fat mess. It was a big fat mess in communications with the teams not understanding, with the commentators not understanding and not being clarified by the FIA. Although I read somewhere that the FIA were actually showing the points as it was going, showing it as a full points race, but maybe no one paid attention. I don't know, but the communication behind it was terrible.
Yeah.
In general, I'm not just blaming the FIA for this. It's the whole situation was just bad, and it just, you know, him winning the world championship was kind of like, I did then.
Yeah, it's a bit of a shame, you know, because it muted his title winning race celebration. That would, you know, it's one thing to win the championship by, you know, squeaking through in fourth and that's enough points. But when you dominate a race and come home and cross the finish line and win, it just kind of takes some of the stuffing out of it.
Yeah, you know? It certainly does. Yeah. Because, Don't I know it, right? But
yeah,
it's everything can take the stuffing out of you. So it was a very muted celebration. It wasn't a world championship celebration as we're used to, and all to do with this whole situation. So it's unfortunate for sure.
Yeah, it's just a lot of egg on the face of F1 in general, FIA maybe F1 more in particular, but F1 in general, I think, takes the brunt of it. And some of that's not really of F1's making. Some of that could be laid at the doorstep of the FIA. But regardless, at the end of the day, some of the newer fans may think, this F1 is just messed up. and they'd be right to say that. They'd be right to have that feeling. I totally understand where they would feel that way. And it is weird. In some ways, I feel like it's becoming sort of clear that Formula One itself and the teams have raised their game. I feel like Formula One, with the onslaught of all the new fans, they've really, since Liberty bought them, they've raised their social media access, the amount of content that they generate for, whether it's their YouTube channel, InstaShame, any of those sort of things. Mm-hmm. They've done a really good job of trying to raise that. They're trying to bring in more races. They have more US races. There's things that they've stubbed their toe on that we could guff on, laugh and point at. But I think in general, they've tried to raise their game. I feel like the teams have done a lot of that too. Stupid thing, but I think Alpine's post-race little interviews that their PR people do with their drivers as they're walking down the paddock are a nice touch. I think Pirelli has a great outreach to the media and press about covering the weekend from a tire perspective. They do a great job. The teams in their technical evolution of the cars, they've all sort of raised their game. The one group that doesn't seem to have really risen to the growth and evolution of Formula One is the FIA at this point.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And I'm not trying to beat them up. But it's kind of a shoe fits, wear it sort of thing. And I feel like, Formula One has evolved and become a technical spectacle that F1 has, but the FIA is still woefully, I think, not fit for purpose in a lot of ways. And I think you bring up the point about professional stewarding and marshalling, et cetera. And I think that's an area, seriously, that the FIA could really assemble a group of professionals that go ahead of the circus and have extensive training and teaching of marshalling ahead, a week ahead to the next race or whatever it might be. And you do that a few times and then all of a sudden you've got some seasoned veterans there. But I think they really need to look at their overall professionalism across the board, I think, and raise their game. Now, I've seen a lot of outrage about that and the FIA. I've even seen several people say, well, F1 should just ditch the FIA. They suck and blah, blah, blah. The one thing I would caution folks about is I've seen a lot of people saying that, but that isn't an option legally, folks. And I would refer you, if you're newer to Formula One too, I would refer you to Max Mosley's biography to get a real clear understanding how the FIA is positioned legally for all motorsports in Europe and beyond. The problem is the FIA are still working sort of on that, older system of car clubs, motorsport, motoring and motorsport clubs and those sort of things around the world. And they're working on that system and electing people and hiring people that may not be true motorsport racing professionals. And I think that's where they could raise their game a little bit in that place. Mm-hmm. Out of all of this, this isn't the only issue that this season has experienced. There's been delays and concerns about some of the calls and consistency. And I feel like Liberty needs to call an all hands meeting over the winter with the teams, the FIA and them, and create an outline of what needs to be addressed holistically. And one of my ideas is, well, since the technical regulation, the technical sporting group of Ross Brawn and Pat Simmons is done with the new car regulations, maybe they ought to move those two over to now the regulatory body and create a regulatory framework that the FIA can adopt and endorse and sick them on that. Maybe that would work.
Not the worst idea in the world, for sure.
No. Why not?
Let's get some people who have got some history.
Yeah.
And I've seen it all.
And seen it all. And those two cats have, for sure.
Yeah.
So anyway, hopefully they'll do something. And then finally, the other thing that came out of this, the other chunk in this Grand Prix broth, was the issue of the full wets and enters. Mm-hmm. And it brought up this question of if the full wets are 4 seconds slower and not fit for purpose, and no one wants to race on them, and they immediately want to switch to enters, whether the enters can handle the conditions or not, then that needs to be addressed, I think. Jensen stated that pretty clearly when he was commenting. He said, well, wait, you know, also you got to factor in these new cars with ground effects. They're going to throw a lot more spray up, and so are the big 18 inch wheels, right? So they're going to be throwing a lot more spray up, during the race. And it's one of those F1 things, Paul, where they're so pragmatic in their approach. They don't sometimes think about the knock-on effects and the multiple permutations of what a regulation change could have, all the way down to viewers or team strategy. But that was kind of, I mean, how do you see the wet tire thing?
I think Pirelli are at fault here. The wet tire shouldn't be that big a spread between the wet and the inter. It really should be a lot closer judgment. It seems it fails so badly, unless it's in monsoon conditions, which, as you pointed out, they won't run in anyway.
Right.
But there should be an option where you've got a better wet that's more like the inter, but it can handle a bit more water. So there isn't just this all or nothing wet intermediate thing, because sometimes I feel the intermediates are a little dodgy on some of the times they've used them. Mm-hmm. When if a better handling, long lasting, performing wet tire was out there, the teams would be much better benefited to use.
Yeah.
So like, and avoid situations like what happened to Carlos Sainz.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So I think maybe that's a point that came out of this. So we had the recovery vehicle on track. You had Pierre speeding. You had, this issue with the point system and then these tire issues and all of this stuff. You know, you kind of take one on its individual terms, kind of like, oh, that's kind of challenging. But when you add it all together, it makes kind of a vote for a bitter stew, you know? It's shambolic comes to mind, the word shambolic.
There you go. But, yeah. The Irish shambolic.
Yes, the shambolic. Mm-hmm. The whole shambolicness of it. Anyway, all right, let's jump into the review, shall we? All right, let's start off at the top of the grid. Red Bull, Sergio Perez, P2, Max Verstappen, P1. Max didn't have the best start, giving Leclerc a sniff at the lead on that initial lap, but he held firm, kept his foot in it, Paul, went around the outside of turn one in torrential conditions. It just told me he had absolute 100% confidence in that car. And just kept his foot at it and was going around. So that allowed him to keep the lead until the red flag came out. After at the restart, though, Max, there's some excuses you can make and disqualifiers, but to me, it seemed a little reminiscent of Schumacher-esque type performance. He clawed out a 27-second lead in just 28 laps, right? It took the win. And you could put some of that down, Paul, to the fact that he was running in clear air with no spray. And maybe that made life a lot easier, and that's why he was a lot quicker.
Yeah.
But he did have an incredibly nice drive nonetheless. The interesting element for me strategy-wise, Paul, was the switch to enters, which was clearly faster as Vettel and Latifi were the first to box and came out on enters and were clearly quicker.
Yeah.
But leading was quicker at that moment, but it was only going to be for a brief window that staying out in the lead without conceding. And man, you talk about a compressed strategy instantly that quick. Yeah. That was the key element of when they switched, and both Red Bull and Ferrari nailed it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, obviously they read what was someone already feed it out. I think Vettel was already like purple sector two very quickly. And then it was like, okay, everyone didn't want to be on the wets anyway, so don't give me too many excuses.
I thought it's
with Verstappen, we know he's very, very good in the wet, and obviously he showed it again. But it's nice to be free of really having a nail-biting run for the championship and know you're going to win the championship. It kind of gives you a lease on life calms you down, gives mm-hmm. you confidence. And you saw all of that in the entry of the turn one.
Yeah.
Really, Charles had the upper hand, although there's a little bit of a camber difference right there mm-hmm. On the outside versus the inside. So maybe I think that had a little bit to do with it. But that comes with sizing up your opponent. Have we talked about having your options open for what happens if this happens, this happens, this happens? Max knew exactly, you know, Charles got a little jump on him. He knew exactly what he was going to do before he even got to the corner. He wasn't making that up as he went along, and right. he executed it perfectly. And that was a key element in getting away from Charles. And he just kind of made her, well, the sun didn't shine actually, but he just used all his skill and pulled away from Charles. And I get the spray thing, but once you're 5 seconds behind, you've got no spray either. And Charles couldn't keep a gap. So it was obvious Max just had the hand on the whole field, really.
Yeah, he did. He wins a second world championship after the points debacle was figured out. It was almost towards the end of the post-race driver interviews, and Johnny had to pull him back and said, oh, by the way, you're world champion. Everybody looked around and said, really? Yeah, oh, okay. And Max was still in the cooldown room.
He still didn't believe it.
No, I didn't get it. And they were like, it did get it? You know? Yeah. And the funny part was they had this little special room for him with like this really nice red chair for him to go sit in, and he goes and he sits there, and nobody's in there with him. And he's just sitting there by himself. Everybody, including JB, are in the cool down room chatting it up. And he finally says, I feel really lonely. Can I come out of here? It's a little odd. Yeah. But anyway, wins a second championship. It did it at the home of Honda. And even though it was a muted.
The new engine partner, who was always their engine partner, who left F1 but didn't quite get out of the. They're like, at least they didn't make the same mistake twice of just leaving and not coming back and then having to start over from scratch. You're like, yeah, maybe we didn't make that right decision. You know, let's make up with our old girlfriend, because I think she was pretty good in the first place.
Well, they should have learned from that when they bailed out in 2009 and sold the team to Braun for a buck.
Yeah.
You know, and then Braun goes on to win the world championship, and then then Honda comes back and, you know, in fairness, gets the hell beat out of him by McLaren. And I knew that was always going to be a tenuous relationship. And I said at the time when they were at McLaren, if they go, they should go to Red Bull, because I bet they would flourish with Red Bull, just kind of the vibe, right? And they did, and they have. And then they said, oh, yeah, we're leaving. Yeah, we're out of here. And now when Audi or VW is looking at it, I was like, we actually might be interested. It's like, pick a lane, Honda. Come on. Yeah,
because they don't want to give their technology back to a different manufacturer also. I think Red Bull, this is half a plan by Red Bull to keep them in. They didn't cut the ties. They didn't say, well, to hell with you guys, we'll just put this engine. Well, not that anyone wanted to give them engines, of course.
Yeah.
But I think it was always in the back of their minds, let's just keep at it with Honda. You never know, they may change their minds. And it seems like that boat is turning around.
So. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And let's see. The reason Max won the title was largely in part to Sergio Perez fall, who hounded Leclerc on the last lap on worn front tires and forced that driver error that saw him cut the chicane, garnering a 5-second penalty, dropping him to third because it paid full points. That made Max a champion. Great drive from Sergio to second place on the heels of a terrific win in Singapore. And now, Paul, he's second in the Drivers' Championship.
Yes, he is. It's a good place for him to be. He's got every right to fight for that. Now Max can kind of back him on his run to the second in championship, perhaps.
Right.
But I don't think that's actually
going to happen. I don't know that he will. That's such a noble charter by any measure, but I don't know that Max will.
Yeah, I don't know. And I don't know as Perez actually needs it, quite honestly. So, a great drive by Perez. Did once again, he's back on the horse in supporting the team and doing exactly what the second driver of that team is there to do.
Yeah.
And showing himself apart from all the other people who they brought in and tried to do that thing for Max. So it's a powerful driver pairing. And I know Perez is like, well, when am I going to get my chance at world championship? Well, that's, I don't know if that will happen, but at least he's in the best car on the grid. So he's going to win some races.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Let's talk about Ferrari. Yeah, Charles Leclerc was P3. Carlos Sainz at DNF. Tough day for Carlos, who spun and hit the wall on the first lap. And, you know, Paul, I ended up seeing a fan video of it online who was sat just across right where he hit the wall. Okay. That was a bigger shunt than I thought it was initially.
Yeah, it was a big fast pretty, part of the track.
Yeah, it was a pretty heavy shunt into the wall there. So I'm glad he's okay. Because of all that energy, you could see why the hoarding and everything just, you know, came out. He was out of the race. Charles had a better start than Max, had a whiff of the lead. Max's pass had a terrific pass on the outside. We talked about it. Turn one kept Leclerc behind him in second place on that first lap. Charles held station really in second, losing time to Max and Sergio, ultimately losing time to both of them. His front tires are starting to lose a lot of grip, really struggling to stay within a shout of Max, couldn't hang on to him, and then later struggled to keep Sergio behind him, and ultimately ran wide at the chicane on the last lap, gained an advantage. According to the stewards, came back out in front of Sergio, and this garnered a 5-second penalty and demoted him to third place. Yeah. There was some consternation over that, Paul. Mattia Bonato getting kind of lippy. I like the chippy, plucky Mattia, you know, kind of getting engaged. Yeah. He's usually takes the higher road, but first of all, it was like his comment about the cost cap, you know. Well, if they spent $4 million, that's worth a half a second. You know, I'm thinking, well, if that's all it took to gain a half a second, what were you doing when you were spending $400 million on a program?
Yeah, and
right?
You were half a second off of Mercedes. You could never claw it back. Yeah,
right.
You just need to spend $4 million. Absolutely.
Right. That's it. Yeah. But anyway, he was not happy with this call. Yeah. He said he was pretty shocked how quickly the stewards reviewed it and assessed the 5-second penalty.
Yeah.
He said, when you consider that just a week ago, it took them 2.5 hours to review, talk to the drivers, and figure out if Sergio had breached the safety car rule. Mm-hmm. 2.5 hours. And yet here, mere minutes after the finish, they instantly assess 5-second penalty. It's done. And he was pissed about that.
Well, I mean, I think it was, in my mind, it was pretty obvious and the quick decision could be made.
There's a lot of people that thinks he didn't have a clear advantage, Paul.
Yeah, it's, if you cut the corner and you stay in front of him,
you got an advantage.
And when you're under pressure, that's an advantage. I've said that from the very beginning.
You have.
Anytime you cut a corner, it's an advantage gained. I don't care if you come out like a second and a half ahead and you were a second ahead before. That's an advantage because you're not driving the same track as the other person,
right?
And you're cutting the course. And if there was a brick wall there, you would have crashed.
That's just it. I was just going to say, right? If there was a wall there, you would have been out of the race. So it is an advantage.
It is an advantage, right? You made a mistake. You went off the road.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I find this way more egregious than track limits on the outside of a turn. And cutting corner is instantly and should be easily penalized, and definitely in that respect, he made a mistake. It allowed him to keep his position, where if he would have had to turn around and come back on the track where he went off, which obviously that would be a dangerous place thing to do, he would have been way behind. So, and that's ultimately what you should technically keep in mind, is where you go off, you should think of what it would take then to turn around and come back out where you went off. Like a runoff, et cetera. That's kind of where that penalty needs to lie. And we saw, remember when Senna and Prost had that clash, right?
Yeah.
That was the same thing. He didn't re-enter where he went off. But that's obviously something they shouldn't do because of the safety aspect of it.
Right.
But
right.
That doesn't belie the fact that it's an advantage gain because you didn't have to crash.
Yeah.
So I think it was an easy penalty. I think it's more to do with, why did the Sergio thing take so long rather than why did this one take so long?
I totally agree with that. I totally agree with that. And I think Mattia was saying, you know, why didn't they, you know, wait and get the driver's input on what happened like they did with Sergio and other things? You know, Alonso in Miami, or, you know, why didn't they do that? But I'm kind of with you. I think it's pretty cut and dry when you cut a chicane and come back on track, still ahead of your competitor who is behind you. But you literally have to block him because he's got the run on you to go around you, and you had to move and block him. It's pretty obvious, you know, that you've got an advantage. And I hate saying that because, as everyone knows, I'm a Ferrari fan, and it kills me to say it. But it was a, I mean, that was pretty straightforward.
I thought so.
And I think you're right. I think the bigger question is, why did it take 2.5 hours to figure out if Sergio won or not? That's crazy.
Yeah.
All right. Let's talk about Alpine, shall we? You had Fernando Alonso in P7, Esteban Ocon in P4. Alpine went from pole, a dual DNF just a week ago, to a serious points haul, and now they're 13 points ahead of McLaren in best of the rest for the Constructors' Championship, which is worth big, big money, right?
This is a big battle, isn't it?
It is a huge battle. Yeah, it is. And so for those of you out there saying, oh, you know, championship's over, Max won, this is a really good battle. Mm-hmm. So you have a lot to look forward to in the next four races of just watching Alpine and McLaren battle it out. It's going to be very interesting. And again, like I said, it's worth millions and millions of dollars to these teams. Ocon, for my part, Paul, had what I feel was one of his best, if not the best, race in F1. Had a very staunch defense against a 7-time world champion while nursing degrading tires. Finished a terrific fourth ahead of Lewis, and Lewis was hounding him for much of the latter part of the race. I mean, throwing everything at him, and I think it was just a terrific job by Esteban to hold him off.
Yeah, it really was. I loved it, and I get that
no DRS,
and we've talked about the DRS kind of took away the art of defense.
Yep,
and this was a classic, extremely entertaining nil-nil draw, so to speak. You know, it was just great seeing what Ocon was doing to counter what Lewis was trying, and vice versa, and just the mind games and the placement of the cars and how they were using all the tools they have to get the job done. And it's not easy not to make a mistake. I mean, you got Lewis Hamilton behind you for 20 whatever laps it was.
Yeah,
it's not easy not to make a little mistake that gives him an opportunity. I get that the Mercedes didn't have the straight line speed, but Lewis Hamilton knows how to pass a car. So I think it was great. I think it was a fantastic battle.
I loved it. And I don't want to overplay this. Really, I'm not trying to be heavy-handed here, but don't miss that nuance in Formula One, because that's the excitement, right? I was chatting with a buddy in Europe earlier this morning, and he said, I mean, it was a good drive by Ocon, but, you know, if they had DRS, Lewis would have been... that's the point.
That is the
point. You're thinking of it completely backward. You know, it shouldn't say, well, yeah, but if it had DRS, it'd be, well, of course, because you got 10 mile an hour more speed, and that would have turned into a nothing burger, and he would have just blown by him and have been over. But yet what we got was lap after lap of fantastic racing. And to Lewis, you and I were talking about it before the podcast, I absolutely loved seeing Lewis, a seasoned veteran, a master in the rain, apply all of his skills. Did you see all the different lines he tried and found grip at and really trying to take the fight? And there was some pretty creative efforts on Lewis. I loved seeing that side of Lewis. It was incredibly fun.
I mean, and he threw equally, everything in the
He did. And equally watching Esteban put on a defensive battle, holding off a 7-time champion, which is no easy feat, was thrilling as hell. I was on the edge of my seat watching that. Is he going to get him? Is he going to get him? That's what you and I grew up with.
Right.
That excitement of, is he going to get him? Oh my gosh, you know.
Rather than, there he is. There he goes.
Yeah. So I understand Lewis didn't get by him. If you're a Lewis fan, you were hoping for DRS. I get that. But the fun of it is to watch that happen and to see that unfold. And it just so happened poor Lewis just didn't have the straight line speed to get by him, which created this imbalance that kept them so close in a great battle, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Don't miss that nuance, because that's what Formula One is. That's why it's exciting. Even if you're you were a Lewis fan at home, you were probably on your edge of the seat. Come on, get by him. It's that excitement, right?
Right, and that's what DRS took away. All exactly. those moments, there could have been a lot more in those these past 10 years or whatever. I understand that sometimes races can be boring, but I get that. I really feel, you know, that this kind of showed, you know, what we actually miss when we don't have DRS.
Yeah, totally agree. So like I said, I'm not trying to be heavy handed or overplay it with you guys, but I found myself just really excited about that, you know, and hell, I'm a Ferrari fan and I'm really excited watching Lewis and Esteban go at it. You know, it was just brilliant fun. Really was. Fernando running very well. Stopped late for enters. Clawed his way back to P7, taking George Russell pretty much at the line there, getting by him and taking P7. A good move on him. And in a lot of ways, this is kind of, you and I've talked about this, about how disappointing Renault's return has been, about how long it's taken them to get to where they are now. But this is kind of where you wanted to see Renault and Alpine, you know?
Yeah.
Right there, best of the rest, knocking on the podium, right?
Yeah, I mean, we still want more, but yes, we do. It's been more consistently, and I think the driver pairing is working out great. It was fun to see Alonso. I'm sure even if Alonso had stayed on the tires he had and finished up seventh, he is way happier. The fight that he had to back through to get there, it really did in the end give him more potential to actually earn a spot. But even though it was a lot of hard work, to do that, I think Alonso just enjoyed the heck out of those last 10 laps. I'm sure he did.
Yeah, for sure. Let's see. Mercedes, Lewis Hamilton, P5, George Russell, and P8. Lewis, again, in my estimation, had a really good race. Started behind Ocon. That's where he finished, but there was a lot more to it than a lot of excitement. Both Mercedes did actually show pace in the wet kind of on Friday. So there was a little hint that maybe if it was a wet race, they wouldn't do too bad or too poorly. Mm-hmm. But the Achilles heel there is that straight line speed. And that was evidenced by that battle between Lewis and Esteban. It just couldn't happen. And like I mentioned, ultimately DRS would have made that a different story. But to be honest, that battle between them and watching Lewis take all the impressive lines, trying to unsettle Ocon, was a lot of fun. You could see that veteran racecraft in him coming out, you know, in the rain. Mm-hmm. Paul and I have talked about it. Paul, you've talked about it on numerous podcasts about when it rains, about how every lap you're hunting for grip, right? Yeah,
and the grip is else in a different place every lap too.
Exactly. Yeah. You said that, you know, the grip, you know, was there on the last lap. It's not here now, you know, and you could see where Lewis was hunting for that grip, trying to find an edge. It was great fun.
Yeah, and you see some of that duck and dive is also trying to get the aero back on the car. Sometimes you compromise your entry or your exit a little bit. So you're not, because if you're right stuck behind the car, then your aero is obviously reduced by a certain percentage. So you'll see them pop out a little bit, even though it's a tighter line, they're getting that air back on the wings to help give some grip. So it was part of that. Part of it is trying to get your opponent to wonder what the heck you're doing out there and get them to do something different that will give you an opportunity for a pass. So
trying to force an error. And to Esteban's credit, he didn't, you know, he did a great job. I'm sure he learned a few moves by watching what Lewis was doing behind him, but it was a great performance. So I thought it was a good race for Lewis up in P5. It really did.
I think they were lucky it was a raid race. I think they had no pace in the dry.
Yeah, I agree.
So they were struggling, I think. So they were very happy for it to be wet. And
Oddly enough,
this was not the track for them. And, you know, they obviously put a lot of downforce in the cars to give them the grip and give them that pace, and maybe got the equation just that little bit wrong, where it was just way too draggy on the straightaway. So
right. Well, George wasn't happy. He wasn't happy with the double stack pit stops. Felt like he lost quite a bit of time there. Yeah. To be fair, I was thinking about that, and I kind of went back and looked at it. I think the team knew what Red Bull and Ferrari knew. They knew that there was this micro window of time to stop from the front of the pack for enters and still cover the midfield who were recovering through the pack on enters. Right. Mm-hmm. And there's that brief micro window of time. And I think even though George was upset, I think the team at least felt like he would have lost more time had they kept him out just one lap later than he would have stacking and getting him out at the same time as Hamilton.
Yeah, it's hard to know. You know, you to get the stopwatch out. I understand what he's saying. I'm not sure how the math works out. Obviously, because when you do the double stack, you tend to back off a little bit just to give yourself a little room so you're not stopped and then have to restart. You want to flow right into the box.
Right.
And so there's some time loss there. And is that more or less time loss than doing an extra lap on the wets? Russell's interpretation was that was the wrong move, and it well could have been. But I think it was a close run thing, probably.
I think so, too.
But also, you know, a very busy pit lane, and you can definitely get hampered very quickly and lose seconds with being stopped while everyone, you know, if you are finished at the wrong time and there's other cars going by in the pit lane, you can't get released. So in my mind, it would have been a better option to let him go around one more lap, considering that, you know, it's not like it suddenly turned dry. I think that would have lowered percentages of time loss rather than the double stack and being in the pits when every one and their father is in the pits, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's, you know, in fairness to George, I think he's not 100% convinced. And I think he's pretty much saying kind of what you're saying was, you know, we need to go sit down, look at all the data, look at the timing, the timing factors, and really kind of understand, because I think he felt like they threw away time there. And he would have been higher up in the order had they did what you just said, which is stay out of the lap, come in, and put on the enters. He felt like they had enough pace to absorb that. And he may be right, but I think it's something they'll probably have to look at. So anyway, regardless, though, George went to work in a mighty way, I might add, by passing Tsunoda and Latifi at the S's, Paul, at turn six.
Yes, what a which move.
Is a very creative and very impressive place to pass. Not a place that most drivers think they're going to be passed.
No, even the Mercedes team were passing that information on to Lewis.
Yeah.
To try and get around Ocon.
And here's the shame of it. George had to get on the radio and compliment himself because the team didn't even say, oh, nice pass. What? I would have been on there and say, hey, great move on six. Yeah, that's awesome, you know? And so anyway, George, like I said, still isn't happy. Thinks there's room in the margins with the strategy, and they'll look at it and see what they can learn. But that's how Mercedes finished. Let's talk about Aston Martin. Lance Stroll in P12, Sebastian Vettel in P6. Sebastian hit Alonso at the start. Spun dropped him to the back. But despite that, Seb and Latifi were the first to gamble on the enters. They dove in immediately, and that paid serious dividends as he finished well up into sixth place. A great race. He loves this track. Of course, who doesn't, Paul? What do you not love about this track?
Right. I mean, I love everything about this track, and it was a shame we didn't get to see a full race, unfortunately, especially after the cup missing a couple of years, because I just love seeing the in-car stuff. I love watching the dicing and the passing and the defending at this track. It's just nearly an ideal race circuit.
Honestly. It is. And the fans are brilliant.
The fans are fantastic.
Just wonderful.
They are. Yeah. They are so deep in.
Yeah.
That's all I can say. They are not just, I'm buying a t-shirt and then walking in. They, you know, that they, if they've got their Lando mask on, they are like Lando all the time.
All the time.
What's Lando doing today? Yeah. It's great happy behind the
Yeah. I love the Japanese fans. They're just brilliant. They're wonderful. Yeah. So a great result for Seb. He loves that track, and a great P6 from him, and a great recovery drive, really.
Yeah, great qualifying too.
Good qualifying too in Q3, top 10. So great weekend on balance for him. It's unfortunate about Lance. He had a terrific start, Paul. He tucked up right against the pit wall. He saw that strip of drier pavement, took advantage of it, passed a bunch of cars on the very front. But unfortunately, I mean, it was an incredibly brave move. And but unfortunately, he stopped late for those enters, unlike Seb, and this left him out of the points. He was out too long on the full wets. It's a shame because I really do enjoy watching what Lance can do in race or yeah. changing conditions, because he yeah. tends to excel in these kind of conditions. And I think that's a neat part of his racecraft. But just an incredibly brave start. I thought it was great.
Yeah, definitely a strong part of his racecraft. You know, obviously we're not 100% convinced he's a top level driver, but right, in these conditions, right. he definitely can go mano a mano with anyone. He yeah. can read the track and sniffed out some grip there right up against the yeah. wall. I mean, hats off to him for doing that.
Right. Yeah. It was a great start. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Let's talk about Williams. You have Alex Albon, a DNF, unfortunately, and Nicholas Latifi. Paul, dare I say, Nicholas Latifi, the legend, Nicholas Latifi in the points. I mean, yeah. how I missed that obvious pick in my fantasy F1 game, I'll never know.
Oh, my God. Talking about fantasy, I didn't even look at the standings. I forgot to put in my predictions this week, so I probably felt like a stone.
Did you? I nailed it, yeah.
Because it seemed like a fairly easy one to predict.
Yeah.
No. But you know what I'm saying? I'm like, well, I yeah. probably would have picked that, but I was like watching qualifying and I'm like, oh, right.
Yeah.
No, I had predictions before
everything right, including safety car. I had everything right except fastest lap. I had Carlos getting fastest lap.
Oh.
Wow. I didn't get that, but I had the podium, everything.
Oh, what's man.
That? Yeah, I jumped 10 places in the fantasy league.
Wow. Yeah. I was like eighth, seventh, you're still eighth there. Last week. Am I? Yeah.
Well, you're still up there, way up there, a lot higher yeah. than I am. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, yeah.
I know.
You can't give any points up, people.
But I did pass Grace. So, you know, that's good.
That's the first step to greatness.
I literally came from the back of this grid because as a Ferrari fan, because like, no, Charles is going to turn it around this weekend. Was I stupid? Gosh. So anyway, I've now flipped over to the Max bandwagon just a couple of races ago. And now I'm working my way back up. All right, yeah. Oh, my gosh. Well, anyway, Alex made contact with Magnussen on the first lap, caused hydraulic failure, had to retire the cars. Unfortunate him. Now, Nicholas, he gambled early like Vettel did for enters, made that strategy work. He scored points as a great result for him. He said that he was really struggling with his tires at the end, but held on to P9. And he was making some passes, Paul. So, you know, it was an inspired drive and a nice consolation prize. Thank you for playing.
Yeah, no, I mean, great for the guy. I mean, obviously yeah. he's on his way out, but he yeah. can have deep satisfaction out of that yeah, drive. Yeah. He made a lot up, kind of like Lance, made up a lot of places at the beginning and did that early pit. And that both those moves were, you know, credited him, got him in the points. So, yeah, I'm happy for the guy to get something out of this season because, yeah. you know, he won't be around next year. So.
Yeah, for a guy that, you know, has crashed several times in perfectly dry race, this yeah. was really tough conditions, yeah. and he did well.
Yeah, he did well. So, he did well. Yeah. So yeah, it was good. As I said, I'm happy for him. Don't have anything against him. He's not the fastest guy out there, but yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, right. McLaren, Lando Norris in what, P10? Daniel Ricciardo in P11. Daniel had a good start, launched up into the top 10. When the race restarted, though, Dan stayed out, kind of like Lance did. He stayed out a little longer. That cost him places, dropped him out of the top 10. By contrast, Lando fell back at the start instead of gained, but he dove in early for enters and that dragged him up into the point. So it was kind of a reversal and they met in the center.
Right.
Unfortunately though, Paul, McLaren, both of them were behind both Alpines and now they're 13 points adrift in the Constructors' Championship.
Yeah.
Despite Alpine's dual DNF last week. So tough.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I expect them to do a little better. Mm-hmm. You know, all things being equalized a little bit by the rain. So I was kind of surprised how much that Lando was floundering and Ricciardo was kind of like normal day for him to a degree.
Yeah.
So yes, I think probably they're very disappointed in their finishing results here. Not something you'd expect or that they have the position to give up those points either with the Alpine battle.
Right. AlphaTauri, Pierre Gasly down in P17, Yuki Tsunoda P13. Pierre had a hoarding, an advertising board from Sainz's crash wrap around his front wing. He dove in for a new wing, got a full set of full wets, fresh set. This dropped him well down in the order. And, you know, it was clear during that stoppage. He was pretty rattled, very upset, understandably so. By the recovery vehicle on the side of the track. I think at some point, you know, when he was talking, he's a little more measured and calmed down, from that, but you know, that gets under your skin and that's kind of tough. But once he dropped down after that stop, it was tough to make it back up, and finish in P17. So a tough weekend for him.
Yeah. Mentally, obviously with Jules being one of his best friends.
Yep.
You know, going away the way he did was, yeah. I can't imagine you can get that out of your head during the race. So I think he was very happy to walk away from that track this weekend, yeah, considering the circumstances.
Yeah, imagine if you would, if you're Pierre, watching your friend go off track and go underneath a recovery vehicle, a tractor, which ultimately he passed from.
Yeah.
And just the extreme nature of that accident in extreme conditions at Suzuka. Mm-hmm. And then you go out there and you blow by a tractor just a few feet from hitting it. Yeah. And you didn't even see it. I mean, you talk about a nightmare, right? Because your best friend or one of your best friends just, you know, passed away from that. So, brutal.
Yeah. Brutal. They were all on edge. The AlphaTauri drivers this weekend for some reason.
Yeah,
a lot of issues, lots of shouting, lots of swearing.
Lots of F-bombs.
Lots of F-bombs.
Yeah, for sure. Yuki may have been set for a point or two. Eddie stopped a little earlier for enters, but that was a critical issue. It was a really narrow window, like I said, to make that call and make that stop. He stopped a little later, and that dropped him down to 13th. And unfortunate, and a lot of F-bombs from Yuki. So.
Yeah, and this is his first race in front of the Japanese crowd.
Yeah, right?
It, you know, he's had a lot better races. I'm sure he's not too happy that was what he showed to his home crowd.
Yeah, I'm sure he wanted to do better than that. Let's see. Haas F1, Mick Schumacher, P18, Kevin Magnussen, P14. Kevin and Mick both had good starts, but they, like some of the other drivers, both of them waited too late to switch to Anders. And Mick was the worse off for the wear because the team said, well, at this point, just keep going. We're waiting for a safety car. That safety car never came, and he tumbled down the order to P18. Hard to blame Mick for that. But ultimately, the team got caught on their back foot with strategy, according to Gunther, and that was kind of evident.
Yeah, definitely evident. Schumacher probably had to make a 2-3 lap window where that strategy of staying on them and waiting for a safety car was going to work. But after that, it was kind of like, okay, I guess this race is over. Pretty much was.
Yep. Let's see. Alfa Romeo dead last. Valtteri Bottas in P15, Joe Guan Yu in P16. So Joe spun on the first lap. That dropped him down the order. He did get the fast lap, I think, or he had it at one point.
I think he kept it. Yeah.
Did he keep it? Yeah. Okay. So he didn't get a point for it because he was out of the top 10. But anyway, so he's got that going for him. Valtteri had a good fight with Magnussen, but I'm really not sure why they were so far off the pace, other than especially maybe Valtteri in the rain. I can sit and scratch my head and go back to baseline and think, gosh, why is Alpha doing? At the end, I think we're seeing a team that's slightly paddling to the end of the season at this point. And that's understandable given the desire to reduce costs. And, you know, I want in my mind, I hate to see him doing that. I want them to do better as a team. And so it pains me to see him back there.
Yeah. Yeah. As you said, just kind of paddling towards the takeover bid, right?
So right.
Everyone's trying to.
We're just going to get to Audi when Audi comes in. We just got to make it to Rock, to Audi. It's a
The less we spend, the more profit we make when we turn it over to them.
Right. Okay, so let's hand out some awards. We always do that. First is move of the race. Who'd you have?
There's a few candidates here, right?
Yeah.
So I love
you and I both had Georgia turned six.
Georgia turned six was phenomenal.
That was one.
You know, that no one else replicated, and he replicated, you know, did it twice. In the end, I feel like it's those early, those pit stops for the Inters that basically helped Vettel and Latifi both score points. I think it was a great call, great driving for them to execute it. In the end, it was the move of the race, certainly for both of those guys.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. Yeah, I had three I was kind of looking at. Max on the outside of turn one around Charles Leclerc, I thought was a wonderful pass and move. I thought Lewis and Esteban, that battle was so much fun to watch. I thought Lewis was driving impeccably well, just didn't have a car to get there. But man, that was a fun battle to watch. Yeah. And then George at T6, at turn six, I thought was brilliant too. So tough to nail them down. I agree with you. You know, there's two or three really kind of interesting moves out of that race that you could pick from. So, but you know, if I had to pick one, I'll stick with Lewis and Esteban because that was really a lot of fun to watch.
Gotcha.
I enjoyed that. All right. Next one is one of our favorites, Paul. It's Donkey of the Race. All right. Donkey of the Race.
Well, I could have said it was the AlphaTauri's bad language, but ultimately the FIA beat them by a country mile for both. Obviously, the truck being on track, which is the most egregious thing they could have done. And also, you know, that whole schmozzle at the end
with the points.
It was a double whammy for the FIA, I think, this weekend.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so AlphaTauri sounded like Seb in Mexico or wherever that was.
they did all weekend long.
They did. What the F and these brakes and this, you know, it's like, whoa, some angry customers over there. For me, I had FIA too, Paul, for sure. All right. Then finally, we do Drive the Race.
Get down. Get in
there, Lewis. All right, Paul.
I got to go with Esteban.
Me too. I got to give it to Esteban. I know the world
only
voted.
Can he give amazing guitar lessons online, he's also a phenomenal F1 driver.
Yeah, exactly. Phenomenal. Who knew? I have the guitar part down. I just don't have the Formula One driver part down. So, I know the world voted Sebastian Vettel, and fair enough. I thought Seb had a great race, but I think Esteban did, you know.
I did. Yeah.
I
can't even tell you how much pressure that is. And the tools that Lewis must have in his chest at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, to parry that is, he came away there using all his energy, I'm sure, but was very satisfied and with the result he claimed.
Yeah, he wasn't holding off Latifi or Yuki or Joe or he's holding off Lewis Hamilton, which is no easy feat by any measure. You know, Lewis has got more tricks in his bag of racecraft. And it was, tough. So I think if you've gone and defended and held on without running off the island while Lewis Hamilton is breathing down your neck, you've done a pretty good job.
I would say.
I wouldn't want to be in that position. No. Trust me. All right. Let's do some mailbag real quick.
You've got mail.
First up, Miles asked this. It seems that when condition warrants wets, the race gets red flagged until inters can work. Do you think that wet tires will ever be used in race conditions? I love wet races, but it seems the thing of a past because of probably rightfully, you know, safety concerns, etc. What would it take to get them back?
Well, as we kind of talked about, I mean, it's Pirelli making a better wet tire, honestly.
Remember, Paul, they had the monsoon tire?
Yeah, the monsoon tire, right?
Yeah. Why don't they do that? If it's really, really wet and you need a tire, you could make the monsoon tire, but the full wets are more competitive.
Yeah, they've got to be closer in speed to the intermediates. That's the only answer to that, really.
Yeah. So it's like, I don't
know. Well, the FIA actually let them race in the rain and not just in damp.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Stop waiting for just damp tracks and let them race in the rain. We used to. What are you, against safety? So I don't know, Pirelli. You have engineers that design tires. Go do it. I don't know how to do it. Yeah. But I think that's a good place to start. Also, Mike says, so you're on a partly dry track with inters. Mm-hmm. How do you figure out when you can make the slicks work? Is it governed by the wettest corner or something else?
Well, it depends how wet is the wettest corner. Yes, to a degree, but the driver has a big game to play here, because even if it's a wet corner, as long as it's not a puddle that you have to drive across, you can evaluate in your head how much time will I lose here versus how much am I going to gain in all the other turns. Mm-hmm. So the driver is doing those equations. I know the team throw their input in there, but as we know, every time, every lap, the track changes. And every time you went through turn nine, you come around, when you're approaching turn nine, you're calculating in your head, okay, what is how has the weather been? Is it sunny out? Is it wind blowing? How am I? I've got to make a guesstimate of how this corner changed mm-hmm. from a minute and a half ago. And that's what you're constantly doing. And you're measuring that, you're kind of seeing how the wetness is coming in from the edge of the track, you know, at a rate. You're also eyeing up other cars on the track and seeing how they're going through that corner before you get to it. That's a big help. And even if there's places where there's water running across, there's a fix for that, where mm-hmm. even on slicks, if you just keep the wheel straight and you don't have any acceleration throttle, you can have constant throttle, you can get through those places and then let the grip on the other side of that patch catch you. Mm-hmm. I know you've been to Sonoma, and I don't think you drove it in the wet, mm-mm. but boy, is that a track where you have to use all those skills.
You would.
You have to know the track. You have to know, you know, how it behaves as it dries, where the wet spots are, because sometimes there's slick spots, but you can find the dry if you know the track, or you can find the extra grip if you know where it's at. So, it's got a lot to do with the driver, the feedback, and the vision a driver has and experience to do that. So I can't tell you there's a definitive moment where everyone should be obvious to him, because it's really not. Also, driving style of a driver can really affect if they can get away with using the slicks or not. You know, if they're a little heavy handed with the brake, with the gas pedal, then they're going to have to wait an extra lap or two before they go to the slicks, because they don't have the finesse to actually work those slicks in the slightly reduced grip conditions.
Yeah, good point. I can tell you, Paul, I wouldn't want to be going down that double apex left-hander downhill turn in the wet. That I would at Sonoma. I wouldn't want to go down that.
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky. It's scary, you know, but it's fun to do it. I remember a race I did at Sebring, same kind of thing. It's like I was flying around people for whatever reason, just because I was basically going straight across the puddle, straddling, then turning the wheel and doing all kinds of crazy stuff. And it's very satisfying when you can read a track better than somebody else, and not all drivers can read the tracks the same, for sure.
Right. And ultimately, at some point during the race, there's going to be one driver like Seb and Latifi. They're going to feel like, I think I can make these work, and they're going to gamble and they're going to do it, you know, and mm-hmm. then you've got a metric, a hard metric, you know?
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, but up until that point, that driver, you know, they got to make that decision. There's a lot of discussion back and forth. So, and then Peter asks, I fail to see why F1 cannot have the same stewards room like the NBA does. They have the connectivity to do so, have a set of seasonal stewards, instant stewardship of every race, judge the same. I think they have that now, Peter. That's what the video review system that the FIA brought in this year, where you have the on-prem stewards that are there, and then you've got a remote set of stewards that are watching all the video that they can consult with to review situations. So they were trying to do that.
There's a lot of data out there, and there's no way you're going to put that in charge of three people. They don't have enough capacity to do that. So it makes sense that there's some people at home with a lot of screens and a lot more people you can have there without having to fly people around the world to do it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so that's it. All right. That's what happened at the Japanese Grand Prix. That's what we think about it, what happened at the Japanese Grand Prix. But I'd be very interested to know what you think about the Japanese Grand Prix. And yes, today the news broke that the FIA certified all the teams, but Aston Martin, Red Bull, and Williams, Aston Martin and Williams just had a procedural breach. And they said Red Bull had an overspend in a procedural breach. So the whole world is blown up. The internet has gone crazy with all kinds of vile crap and stuff being said. So we'll maybe Grace and I can break some of that down.
We always said it was going to be extremely difficult to police this. And I think it could even be really, even for a team to police themselves to some degree.
I agree.
It's a learning game. What the repercussions are, I don't know. I haven't read the rules on if you're this much over, if what are
there are varying severity, you know.
But if it's under interpretation, kind of like penalties on the track.
Yeah, if it's under 5%, then there's these penalties that they could do from fines to deduction of points to exclusion from events. There's a series of penalties. And, you know, a lot of people are out, you know, saying, you know, posting this video, just a little clip of Ross Barron saying, well, if there's any fraudulent, you know, breach of it, you know, you lose the championship, it's all over. Well, but that video is a little out of context, you know, because what he said just before that was that there are varying levels of penalties based on the severity of the breach. Mm-hmm. So they missed that. So this is with the internet.
Conveniently,
this is where the internet falls down because they're just propagating some narrative that would get Lewis the championship because they're not happy about it. And that, I get it. But at the end of the day, I said, you said, Grace said, we all said this years ago, 2018, 17. We even said it when they did remember the resource restriction program they did, the gentleman's agreement. We said, well, that's laughable. And it was. And then when they were going to do the cost cap, there's a major issue. So I posted a story on the website, theparkforme.com, and you can go read it. I don't know. The FIA has got to go through the process. If Red Bull overspent, then by all means, you know, penalize them and whatever the regulations say. I'm a little less concerned about that than I am about the simple fact that how did Toto and others know that Aston Martin and Red Bull had breached the regulations a week or two ago? That to me outweighs everything, because the very organization that you're asking to adjudicate, to regulate and audit this process is the same organization that apparently is leaking information.
Correct.
These teams are private companies. And I said back then that having independent people come in and plow through your books is not a comfortable thing for any business, and their accounting processes and everything else, that's all business intelligent and intellectual property. And so if someone is leaking stuff to Toto, and a lot of allegations are his personal attorney now is a very high
old buddy.
She's a very high ranking person now at the FIA. There's those allegations, right? So for me, yes, the overspending, then, you know, mete out the penalty that you see per your regulations. But the leaking and disclosing of information is the whole reason I think this has got to be stopped.
Yeah. And the biggest squawkers are the people who have a manufacturer base that can hide certain spends anyway.
Bury the R&D.
And we did talk about that.
We did.
Red Bull are a race team. Mercedes and Ferrari are manufacturers, and they have a lot of resources that they can hide their spend. So I'm not buying it all anyway.
I'm not either. Do you know how much hydraulic system R&D you could bury in Ferrari's road car division? Or Mercedes?
It'd be astounding. Well, I mean, you say you're working on the next hypercar, and
what
is hypercars nowadays? The new Mercedes hypercar is based on the Formula One car. You can do all kinds of ways to hide that stuff.
Yes, you can, and so I'm not buying it, and so that's why I've said all along I thought this is a very bad idea that would lead to this, and it has. I said it would lead to issues about integrity, auditing, leaking of information, and it has. And you could bury these costs. That's uncontrollable or manageable. Mm-hmm. And that's why in my editorial today. I said this needs to stop, and they need to come up with a more elegant solution than this.
Yep, they certainly do.
So anyway, all right, we'll dive into it next week. Hey, if you like this podcast, go over to iTunes, give us some love over there and a good rating. A huge thank you to our Patreon supporters, because as we said at the top of this podcast, we did not overspend on this podcast. It's clear. I had somebody give us
obvious.
It's obvious.
Picture for crying out loud.
I know. I had somebody give me a bad review the other day and said, "Oh man, this is, you know, it just feels like they're pulling it out of the closet." And you know, there's so many other F1 podcasts out there. They need to, you know, get different sound bites and so. And it's like, dude, you're right. There are a lot of other F1 podcasts. Go listen to those. I'm sure all of them are better than ours. Realize we don't overspend on this podcast. Yeah. We all have day jobs. It's a fan podcast. And that's the intent. So our patrons are huge, huge elements of our support here. And we can't thank you enough for that, because without it, we would not and could not do this podcast. So thank you so much for that. Also, I think that's it. Also, we'll be back. I got to find Grace. It'll be interesting to get Grace's take on this, as well as the Japanese Grand Prix. I'm sure she'll have some wonderful Gracisms that come out of this, and we'll talk about that. And until that time, Paul, it's been awesome having you on the podcast. We're going to come back in a couple of weeks and talk about the U.S. Grand Prix.
Ooh. Yeah, I might be able to hear the sounds
of their engines.
Yes, I might be able to hear their engines from my house.
How do you like driving that?
It's good. Yes,
you
great.
Like it?
I mean, yeah.
How tough are the S's?
I mean, they're tough, but it's a rhythm thing for sure. Mm-hmm. But I'd love to attack in a really fast car.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I've been at it in a Ferrari street car, but in a proper car, that's where you're really going to.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah.
Get your teeth in.
You and I haven't talked about it. I know you've driven it before, but and more times than Danica Patrick.
yeah, just getting into the, it's all about setting the S's up at the beginning, coming out of two, getting the vehicle straight and flat, and get the car in the right attitude and speed so you can carry more speed into the S's and but still have the grip to change direction and get the hell out of there. But
yeah. If you've never had Paul teach you how to do S's, I am a very blessed guy because I have, and we did it in an R8. But it is so cool. The art of driving and how to attack those S's. And the S's at Sonoma, and I was going through them like this, and Paul was like, "Okay, wait a minute." Time out, tough guy. Okay, here's how we do the S's. This is how you do this, because once you screw up on the first S, it carries through the whole thing. You're toast by the time you get to the end of it. Yep. And I was like, "Whoa!" And so anyway, yeah, he showed me how to do that. It was awesome. Great time.
Anyway,
it was a good time. So anyway, all right. Well, we'll be back with Paul to do the U.S. Grand Prix next week. We'll be back, Grace. Until that time, this is Todd, a.k.a. Negative Camera, saying so long.
That's it, man. Game over, man. Game over.
I don't really feel I've got to prove at all. I don't really want to prove anything. I started as an amateur with no idea or no intention of becoming world champion. I was curious to find out what it was like to drive a car fast, to drive on a certain circuit, to drive a certain type of car.